The Guardian.
Hello, and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Jemima Kish, and we're about to do some crystal ball gazing as we look into what the next 12 months should have in store for the world of technology. This week, we look at the exciting future of connected television. What will be the blockbuster games of 2011, what devices we'll be buying, and what we think will be updates to the ones we already own. In the studio is The Guardian's games correspondent, Keith Stewart. How many mince pies have you had, Keith?
About 30 a day.
Robert Andrews of Paid Content UK is with us too. Much Baileys, Robert?
Yeah.
A hell of a lot.
Not as many mince pies as Keith.
There was one year I got through an entire bottle of Baileys in one Christmas day, but let's not go there. Let's kick off the teenies with a look at what's coming up. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Our first prediction for 2011 is a guess at what will be the future for the box in the corner of your living room.
While normal TV guides only show you what's on now or later, the UView guide will also go back in time, so you can watch what was on yesterday or even last week.
It's what the people want.
But this is just the beginning. You'll get all kinds of content through UView from all sorts of providers. And once developers start creating apps, who knows what your TV could do? All you'll need is your TV and broadband, plus a UView box.
UView, the project formerly known as Canvas, will bear fruit in 2011. The service will offer you free television and radio like Freesat and Freeview, but over your internet connection. What's really interesting is that the box will also be able to run apps that tie to your viewing experience, so you could potentially tweet and Facebook on the same screen you're watching TV on. UView is just one of the many ways you'll be connecting your television to the net over the next year. Apple TV and Boxy are already out. Google TV is on the horizon, and there will be a big push on internet-connected televisions this year from manufacturers like Sony. Robert, what does UView actually look like? Can you describe what the thing looks like that we'll have in our living rooms?
So initially, it will be a box. It'll be a thing that sits underneath your television. Imagine it as Freeview connected to your broadband. And in the same way as happened with Freeview, initially it shipped on a set-top box. It will allow you to pull down video on demand over the broadband connection plugged into the box, which is plugged into your TV. In time, in a year or two, it will begin to become integrated into the TV. And I think that's what's most exciting. It will mean that people up and down the country who buy a new TV from probably end of 2011, early 2012, will be able to plug their broadband directly in the back and pull down a range of video on demand from the UK's main public service broadcasters, but also internet video content. And I think that's going to be particularly exciting, and you'll begin to find a range of new programming on there. No longer will we be limited to linear TV channels or VOD from the main broadcasters. UView is also using words like apps and app store to suggest what else we might be able to do with the system, which I think is particularly exciting. But let's see, because primarily this has been conceived as a video on demand platform, and there's not yet any real indication as to what an app store paradigm might look like on there.
Well, it sounds like a fairly niche service. Is this really going to work in the UK if your broadband isn't that fast? And what if ISPs are moving to restrict bandwidth and service blocking on things like iPlayer? I mean, it's not something that's going to go down terribly well with them, is it?
Well, I mean, remember that two ISPs are part of the UView joint venture, and also that the entire joint venture conceived the project in a world that predates the recent commitment the Condem government have given to superfast broadband in the next few years. In fact, UView was conceived under the paltry 2 megabits per second commitment that the Labour government made. I think, you know, you just have to assume that in time we'll get faster broadband connections. And anyway, there is a minimum quality threshold with which UView will operate.
Further down the road, the apps offering could become very interesting, and the logical ones, all the services that we already use, Facebook and Twitter and so on, are fairly easy to visualise on the service. But are there any more imaginative uses or applications of services that we could see on this platform?
as with any app platform, games are going to come into it.
Says Keith, rubbing his crystal ball furiously.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm rubbing furiously. I think a lot of the developers that we're already seeing making games for the big broadcasters. So there's a lot of small developers that in this country that specialise in making games for broadcasters. People like Preloaded, Little Loud, Plugin Media. These companies are all talking about the possibilities with UView. And we're already seeing a lot of youth-centric TV programmes like Misfits, Psychoville, Skins, that are using kind of connected media in a lot of ways. And when UView comes in, it's logical to assume that there will be a Skins app, a Misfits app, a Psychoville app, that people will be able to sort of interact with the shows a lot more kind of readily in front of their TVs. So I see games as being a part of the UView package, I think, although they will be very basic games to begin with. It'll be like Flash was about 5 years ago, maybe.
That gets very exciting when you could see storylines being woven between an interactive app and the sort of passive TV experience. Google TV's proposition is a little different, being largely built around search, as you might expect. They have had some problems in America, though. Services like Hulu have been blocking Google TV. How's that expected to pan out?
So have the networks. All of the networks there operate their own video on demand, catch up TV programming on their websites. And Google TV is essentially a platform with a web browser. So Google has assumed that users of that platform would just be able to use the built-in web browser to go to those websites and get a full-screen video experience. Actually, you know, the TV industry is something that is hideously dependent on rights and windows and territories and still wedded to that. And so the networks are saying, well, no, we actually need a deal from you in order to do this. And I think the Google TV platform is very exciting, but I foresee big problems ahead with that. And there's also a big question mark as to whether people want to use search as the navigational mode on their TV, as opposed to an EPG where they can just browse. Do you necessarily know what you want to search for, or do you sit down and simply want to be entertained?
Elsewhere in TV, TiVo is going to make an appearance in the UK after an eight-year absence. But Virgin Media boxes already record if you want them to. I have one of those at home. I don't think I've ever actually recorded anything on it because I don't have time to watch TV. But is that going to see these two services go head-to-head in the UK?
So everything's going to come into the mix. I think you're going to find UView fighting Google TV, fighting Virgin TiVo. I used the Virgin TiVo box recently. It is very nice. It's based on TiVo Premier that has been operating in the States. Again, as well as the VOD, it does have a range of apps you can access. Pandora, Rhapsody, Netflix on there. So it's a big opportunity for other content distribution services, particularly the subscription premium distributors, to offer their services over to these boxes in a way that they couldn't have using just a standard dumb TV. And so when you think about Virgin and TiVo in the UK, you wonder whether we're going to be seeing the likes of Spotify and Love Film being delivered to our box.
One of the things that Microsoft showed off at the Kinect launch was the whole video experience, in that you could have a video conversation with a friend, and there'd be a picture of you on one side on your camera, a picture of your friend on the right-hand side, but in the middle could be a piece of media content that you're both viewing together remotely and experiencing it together. And this seems to me an obvious thing for UView and other services like it, this whole idea of people remotely watching TV and experiencing TV together.
I think it could be huge. And BSkyB is already doing a similar thing with Microsoft in this country. Xbox users can call up their Xbox Live friends and together as a group watch a Premier League football match. Not actually, I think, with video, but a bunch of avatars together in a room, and they can chat to each other. I also know that Boxy does allow people to share their viewing preferences as they're watching it. And Skype is really interested in video conferencing over the TV screen. And so I do certainly think it's possible to imagine a world in which televisions ship with cameras that allow you to interact with fellow viewers, friends, but also perhaps with the TV screen.
And here we'll insert a lazy TV-related phrase like, watch this space. Another year, another new phone, and this year's eagerly anticipated device looks set to be the PlayStation phone. So, Sony's made a success of the PlayStation and the PSP. Can they go one better and squeeze it all into a mobile phone? Keith, what are the chances of them pulling this off?
I don't know. This has been around for a very, very long time. The PSP-based phone, the rumour's been out there for a few years. And Sony's kind of prodded at it a few times. They've obviously had the PSP Go, which was a totally kind of digital-based console, which didn't do enormously well. There's also been PS3 functionality or connectivity in a range of Sony mobiles. I just think it's one platform too far, maybe, for Sony. I don't know if there is an enormous market for a video game console branded phone.
Especially when it's up against so many games apps on so many different phones.
Exactly. I think everyone's got used to the fact that they can use their iPhone and Google Android phones for games, and Windows 7 phones are also obviously also going to be quite strong for games as well. I just don't know what USP Sony are going to bring to this apart from the PlayStation brand. If it has really, really good interconnectivity with PlayStation Network, which is the sort of online service for PlayStation and PSP, then maybe there's a chance of it being successful, but I just think it's a brand extension, maybe too far for Sony.
It's been predicted that the phone would run Android and have a section of the Android market that would be just for their game. So that would be quite a boost for Android if it happened, wouldn't it?
In terms of brand extension, maybe. I don't know. I don't see the killer concept behind it, really. I think it'd be amazing if something like Little Big Planet arrived on this phone with lots of amazing functionality that wasn't available on PlayStation. They need to do something with their really big game brands to make it really, really interesting. And I just cannot see Sony jumping into this space like they did with PlayStation into the console space all those years ago and totally disrupted it. I don't see them in this disruptive space here.
Robert, Nokia seem to be in some sort of terminal decline, don't they? What's going to happen to them this year? I mean, is the pressure on them to produce a killer handset? What do they need to turn their business around?
Yeah, new chief executive in 2010 has come in. Surely he will have considered the options such as, do we ship Android on our handsets? Do we move to Microsoft Windows? The guy came from Microsoft, and Nokia has had a strategic relationship with Microsoft for some time. In actual fact, what's happened is they've looked at Symbian. They're now doubling down on Symbian. The Symbian Foundation, which runs the operating system on Nokia phones on a sort of non-profit basis, is actually being absolved into Nokia. So it seems that the way Nokia tackles it is not to be tempted by Android over here and Microsoft over here, but actually to stick with what it knows, but just do it a whole lot better. Nokia's hardware is fine, but they need an operating system on there that feels like it's fresh, new, written today for touchscreens. And, you know, if it doesn't succeed in 2011, then they're in difficulty. But they seem to be tackling the problem by taking more control of Symbian.
Well, while we're on mobile, we'll no doubt be talking about this in the spring. Deja vu, anyone?
For 2010, we're going to take the biggest leap since the original iPhone. And so today, we're introducing iPhone 4, the fourth generation iPhone.
The launch of iPhone 4 with Steve in 2010, and now that the world has the iPad, we should see an update to that this year as well. What do you expect on those devices, Robert?
Camera on the front is the big one, possibly on the back as well. It would be no big surprise that's already happened on the iPhone and I think the iPod Touch. Clearly, they're looking at FaceTime as the big opportunity there. I do wonder whether they're ever going to make good on the promise that FaceTime would be open, would become an open standard. If not, you're looking really at people using their iPad to talk to other users of an iPhone or an iOS device or a Mac OS X device.
Someone did overhear another passenger on the train the other day say, "Oh, I'll FaceTime you later." So maybe they're slowly sneaking into the...
Is it Steve Jobs?
No. Meanwhile, Apple has about $50 billion in the bank. What do you think it should spend that on? Anything out there it should be acquiring?
I think we probably need to do a little bit of work on sat-nav on the iPhone. There, you know, Android does that free. It works quite well. Google Maps is on iOS and is nice, but they, you know, it looks like they need to step up the mark on SatNav. I can well imagine a couple more acquisitions in the mobile advertising space as they look to make improvements to the iAds system that they introduced this year.
Keith, what do you think Apple could do in the game space? And they introduced the Game Center last year, but is there much more potential there for Apple in the gaming space? Could they be consolidating their services in some way?
Maybe, yeah. I don't think Game Center has been taken up by as many people as they would have hoped, because there were already legacy services like that, sort of OpenFaint being the major example. So there were third-party companies that were doing similar kind of Xbox Live but on your iPhone services, and I don't think Game Center represented a significant enough move on from what those parties were offering. I'm not quite sure what Apple can do with Game Center, but I think it really does need to look at Xbox Live and the strengths and the tightness of that service and produce something similar. It's just, at the moment, when you're given the opportunity to sign up for it through an app, I actually think one of the main problems is that the most successful applications on iPhone and iPad are single-player games. With Angry Birds, there isn't that kind of impetus in some ways to go online. So maybe what Apple needs to do is kind of evangelize its idea for Game Center more to developers and get them to develop more multiplayer themed games.
There you are. Spend some of your $50 billion on games developers. In the tablet area, there'll be a lot more competition in 2011. HP, Palm's WebOS, BlackBerry's Playbook, and more Android tablets. Any of those whet your appetite? Any you're looking forward to?
The Android tablets.
He's furiously shaking his head.
I'm fed up with tablets.
Okay.
We've already, you know, we've seen the Samsung Galaxy Tab, but technologically under the hood, that is basically just a big mobile phone. And a lot of these Android tablets that have hit the market right now, they're quite poor, actually. Technologically, we've seen one from Next, the fashion retailer, underpowered. And often they don't include the Android market either, which significantly puts the kibosh on the app opportunity there. But looking ahead to not the next release of Android, which is codenamed Gingerbread, but the one after that, which is codenamed Honeycomb, that's going to be a version that is tailored for the tablet devices. Right now, the flavors of Android are basically designed for mobile. And so you're going to see, I think, later in 2011, full-size equivalents to iPad, about the same size, that you know, can really take advantage of that size screen.
Well, while we're talking of tablets, those devices are predicted to introduce a new way of playing games. Keith, let's take a look at gaming now. What are your predictions? Tell us about tablet gaming.
Do I have to? So far, really, I have not seen any games that have really used that screen space to make themselves really genuinely stand out from games that are on iPhone, but just looking a bit bigger. There's so much room there for games to exploit that bigger kind of real estate, that bigger space, to make more intricate movements and a better use of multi-touch. There are so many great point-and-click games in the PC era in the early 90s that would just work beautifully on iPad. Not that you should always look backwards for your ideas, but we've already seen a brilliant translation of Monkey Island, and there's so many games like that that would benefit from this larger screen and the ability to interact more kind of tactilely with it. Is this tactile a word?
Possibly it is now.
I've been kind of disappointed with iPad functioning apps so far, because I really don't think they've investigated the advantages of that platform apart from to make the screen slightly bigger.
Well, it's almost like in the first generation of games, you have to get the obvious things out of the way, like just a sort of an iPad version of another game. And then in the second generation of development, developers and designers would hopefully really start thinking about the sensors and the features on those devices. So the fact that it's mobile, the fact that other people are nearby, the fact that it has a gyroscope in it, and all of those things could inform gaming. Is that what we should anticipate? More imaginative games like Papa Sangro?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's what will hopefully happen. It's difficult in a way, because you have this enormous mainstream market for games on Apple devices. So if you think about the most successful games, Angry Birds, Cut the Rope, stuff like that, they're really basic games which could have been out on home consoles years and years and years ago. So I think this is one of those occasions where there is going to have to be an amazing killer app which promotes location-based gaming or promotes tactile gaming that just hasn't happened yet. And I haven't heard of anything and there's thousands of games in development, but I've not heard of one which just made me think that's what could happen on iPad that couldn't happen anywhere else. That's what uses the enormous screen and location-based facilities that I've not seen before.
How will cloud gaming change the way that we play games, and should it matter to players what's going on in the background?
No, it shouldn't, and that's possibly what cloud gaming is all about. The fact that you don't need to buy a quad-core Intel processor to run games over the internet. The whole OnLive business model is about playing the latest games on whatever knackered old PC or laptop that you own. OnLive hasn't come out in this country yet. It's coming out, I think, in the autumn, and they've done a deal with OnLive, have done a deal with BT, so it'll be coming out through BT first to BT customers. It'll be interesting to see how that fares. It's kind of doing all right in the States, where people have said that the performance they get out of streamed games is reasonably good. You're not getting a totally high-end experience. You're not getting amazing visuals, but you're getting a decent video game experience being streamed to you live over the internet, which is quite incredible. I don't know where the business model is going. I don't know if it's going to get the mainstream momentum it needs, but it's an interesting space, but it's definitely a watch this space.
There's a couple of big sequels coming up this year. We've got Little Big Planet 2, Crysis 2 and Dead Space 2. So what are the stories and how have they moved those on?
I don't think they've moved them on that enormously. I mean, there are dozens and dozens of sequels out next year. There's Diablo 3, Max Payne 3, Uncharted 3, Infamous 2, Mass Effect 3. Mostly they're incredibly incremental. Development budgets are just so astronomical now. It very much is going along the Hollywood line of commission a sequel almost immediately. Think about the intricacies later on and play it safe. I think next year is going to be dominated in some ways by very, very large sequels that don't really take us enormously further than the games before. I think where next year is going to be interesting is in some original games. Rockstar has L.A. Noire coming out, this 1940s-based L.A. Detective drama, which has... The trailers are showing amazing cinematics, a really lifelike human animation. You know, Rockstar hit the ball out of the park with Red Dead Redemption last year. This is by a different development studio, Team Bondi, in Australia, who have been working on this game for a couple of years. And it just looks really interesting. Then you've got Last Guardian from Team Ico, the people that made Ico and Shadow of the Colossus on PlayStation, an amazing Japanese development studio who have produced two of the biggest cult games ever, a beautiful game. Shadow of the Colossus and Ico are just amazing. Last Guardian is probably out next year. And again, it's a kind of fantasy-based adventure with strong emotional undertones. And you just think, these guys have got to be the ones that take this generation of gaming just further in terms of storytelling, in terms of emotional content. And a complete flip side of that coin will be Bulletstorm from Epic and a Polish company called People Can Fly, which is this ridiculously over-the-top shoot 'em up, which takes all the dynamics of that genre and just accelerates them. And that just looks hilarious. Looks like really great fun.
How about Nintendo 3DS? It's being released in Japan in February, so it's already missed the Christmas market. But can 3D work in a portable device? And how does it work? Do you need those silly glasses? Do you have to wear those in public?
No, you don't. Nintendo 3DS works around a technology called parallax barrier technology, and it's a way of given a stereoscopic effect without 3D glasses. So you just look at the screen, and because it's a small screen and because it's right in front of you, parallax barrier technology is quite limited in that if you move away at a certain angle, it doesn't work. But if you've got a very small screen right in front of you, it works fine. It's the same sort of technology that's used in 3D mobile phones in Korea and Japan. And it's actually a really, really nice implementation. I've played with it a couple of times. I've seen some of the launch games, some of the really early games like Kid Icarus. There's a Resident Evil game coming for it. There's a Metal Gear Solid game coming for it. And they just look lovely. What you get there with 3D at that level is you get a certain amount of miniaturization of the characters. So all the characters look like little painted lead figurines. But it's just lovely. It's kind of almost magical. I don't think it's the most technologically advanced use of 3D, but I think it is going to be successful because Nintendo will bring it out at the right price point with the right games, and they have a way of working with technology, and it doesn't matter if it's off-the-shelf technology from a couple of years ago. Everything works for them because they just have the right games. I think it's going to be massive.
The The coalition government has settled into business and spent the latter half of 2010 making noises about net neutrality and a porn filter for the net. Along with the judicial review of the Digital Economy Act that ISPs TalkTalk and BT won, it could be a busy 2011 for the lawmakers. So the Digital Economy Act review, is this just delaying the inevitable, or are there legitimate concerns from these ISPs, Robert?
Well, the act was passed, received royal assent. Sorry to everyone about that. But, you know, not only has many aspects of the act not actually been implemented yet, I think there are three main reasons that a lot of it could unravel or be superseded by new law in 2011. So, number one, the BT and TalkTalk are receiving the judicial review that you referred to. Two, a parliamentary committee has commissioned its own review into how effective the act might be. And then third, and probably most importantly, the government has also tapped Ian Hargreaves to conduct a review of how intellectual property law in this country works as regards digital, and whether there are any barriers to creating digital business models there. So the subtext of all this is general suspicion toward the act in its current form. It looks like some MPs want it to unravel. And I think with Ian Hargreaves' review, you're going to find similar kind of lobbying that we saw in 2010, both from the entertainment industries on one side and the pro-rights lobby on the other. But also some new lobbyists come to the fore. For example, news aggregators like Meltwater and search companies like Google. I think they're going to be you know, putting their case on whether content is free to crawl and free to index. You know, just what does intellectual property law mean in this age?
Ed Vasey's comments on net neutrality and ISPs filtering out porn, how is he likely to address those this year, do you think? And is it just bluster, or is there actually going to be some action there?
I think neither of those points are necessarily bluster. The porn filtering thing is something that already happens on mobile networks. If you take out a new contract with the likes of Vodafone or T-Mobile, you already have to request an unblock, a content unblock, if you want to go to Flickr, of all things. It's not a website known for hosting a great deal of porn. Net neutrality, I think it is going to happen because, again, the ISP and the carrier lobby is getting quite vocal about just the pressures their networks are under.
Fibre broadband rollout will be happening by BT and Virgin Media next year. What will the benefits be of that, and what will it be used for? And is this really for massive download fans or music fans? Who is that likely to benefit?
So eventually, I think it's going to benefit everyone who has multiple boxes and devices in the home that are using the internet regularly. So people who are playing online gaming, streaming music, watching IPTV that we talked about, all at the same time, multiple people in the family doing that. BT's fibre product is already, I think, being installed in new build homes.
Isn't part of the problem with fibre, though, when we're told about fibre optics, they're talking about back-end infrastructure, whereas one of the big problems with fibre optics is that is what they call the last mile, isn't it? And the fact that it can be fibre optics right up until your local junction. But then what if your home isn't a new build and it was built in the 40s or 50s, and what you've got then from the local junction box to your house is just a piece of copper that's been there for 40 years? Then that has an effect. It's not fibre to the home. Is that correct?
Well, I think, you know, Virgin Media is already a fibre network, and they keep saying that their network is capable of at least 200 megabits per second. So their network is, you know, quite future-proofed, and most of that is right to the home. Yeah, BT's product is one of two things: fibre to the cabinet, the local box, or fibre to the home. You know, I mean, clearly we know which one of those you'd rather. But I think fibre to the cabinet is nevertheless that much more quicker than the copper to the cabinet. That, and we're getting techie here, but to the extent that I understand it, the contention rates from the cabinet to the home are nevertheless quicker than they otherwise would be.
And also, if you're in an area where everyone tends to be students or young families like me, then the contention rate is massive and the broadband you actually get is pretty dribbly, shall we say.
Is that a technical term?
Yep, that's a technical term.
Okay.
The constellation of the web's brightest social media stars flickers a little differently today than it did a year ago, with Facebook bigger and brighter than ever and Yahoo's star on the wane. Facebook now has 633 million users, according to ComScore, and is aiming for 1 billion, with revenues of an estimated $2 billion for 2010. Yahoo, on the other hand, is shedding both users and staff, with Chief Executive Carol Bartz facing a deadline of the end of 2011 to turn the company around. How is she going to do that, Robert? Is she going to have to sell off Flickr, one of her crown jewels?
Yeah, and not necessarily for the reason of making bucks, but just to shed things that they no longer have an interest in doing. I'm not sure that Flickr's ever really been the jewel in the crown. There was a point where Yahoo really wanted to leverage all this social stuff for the purpose of creating a network of content. They seem to have given up on that now and seem more interested in creating online content in the traditional media way, which seems to be the same strategy that AOL has. And so, yes, those two have got to get together in some kind of merger or acquisition relationship in 2011.
There was speculation that AOL was sniffing around Yahoo, which was only the latest company after Microsoft's prolonged attempt to buy the company, and that fell through as well. The pressure is all on Carol Bartz, and it has been said that if she doesn't be shown to make a difference by the end of 2011, she'll be out. Is that the way you see it?
I mean, make a difference. The thing that probably would make a difference is pairing it up with AOL. In which case, she still might not be the one to stay on, because that's, you know, that combined company would need a chief executive, one chief executive. I don't know. I think that this period hasn't necessarily hurt Yahoo or AOL. You know, they've both been shedding social sites over the last year. Their respective new chief execs have spent the last year downsizing, cutting back, and actually aligning both of those companies' strategies. I think, you know, that the last year since all that Microsoft talk won't have been too damaging, and we'll have got both AOL and Yahoo in a sufficiently fitter condition for an eventual pair-up.
When I was writing a bit of script for this piece, I inadvertently called Carol Bartz Carol Decker, but of Tapao. I don't know where that came from in my memory.
But Yahoo, China in her hand.
That's exactly the point I was going to make. But thank you very much. Anyway, moving on, Facebook. This will be another massive year for them, in all likelihood. It's very difficult to predict where Facebook will grow, particularly in its feature set, because it develops so fast. But what would you expect them to be looking at expanding this year in terms of their offering to consumers?
The Places feature to actually start to gain some traction, I think. Never mind Foursquare, never mind Gowalla, unless you are interested in collecting badges or playing the location games. I think only a network with the scale of Facebook could popularise that. And they also need to really start profiting from social advertising.
Any chance they might put a bid in for Groupon? Because there's a massive logical tie-up there, isn't there?
Yeah, a scarily exciting prospect, I think, combining daily deals with social networking, yes. One of the things I do wonder about Facebook is, clearly, phenomenally successful company. Zuckerberg, the star of the movie recently, and named Times Person of the Year. But Facebook has also made some missteps this year, you know. More privacy scandal, continual updates and redesigns on the webpage and tweaks. What is it ultimately that they're looking to do with things like the design and things like that? I wonder whether Facebook is becoming a company, you know, a product built by Zuckerberg, and whether he's now the right person to run that company as a business. You know, back in 2010, we saw Evan Biz at Twitter, the guys who started that company, built the product, take a back seat as far as running the business goes, and promote the other guy to actually do all that stuff and run it as a business and try to make money. So I think you might see with Facebook a sort of more of a separation from the product, between the product leadership and the business leadership.
And moving on to Twitter, they may be opening their UK office early next year. Are we going to see any direct evidence of that, or is it just a sort of a PR base, do you think?
I think that opening a European office in London just shows how Twitter has built the product to a certain extent now. Many of the key technical and business things are in place. 2011 now is money-making time for Twitter. They've got a lot of the key things in place on the technology side and on the business side as regards strategy. Opening a UK office is really all about getting ad sales, people on the ground there, and starting to sell ads, promoted tweets to people. And I think that will be the difference, that we see local ads for UK eyes and not just Virgin Atlantic promoted tweets.
Well, that is it for the Tech Weekly preview of 2011. If you're listening before the 1st of January, we hope you have a rollickingly good new year. Thank you very much to Keith and to Robert for playing Mystic Meg this week. Alex is back in the hot seat next week. She'll be talking with Sue Gardner of Wikimedia about where the money goes when Jimmy Wales pops up and asks for donations for Wikipedia. And in 2 weeks' time, we'll have highlights from Charles's trip to the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. I'm Jemima Kish. Tech Weekly was produced by Scott Corley. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.